You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Find out where The Takeaway is playing in your area by going to thetakeaway.org/stations.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. We have a lot to get to in this next hour, but let's first go right to our top story, another winter storm that's already left more than 750,000 Americans without power. The system that shut down much of the South and Mid-Atlantic yesterday is now taking its toll on the Northeast. Governors from Louisiana to New Jersey have issued states of emergency, and for many, the challenge of this storm has come in the form of ice. Ice that can create conditions that in the past day have been variously called catastrophic, historic. John Kraft is spokesperson from Georgia Power. He joined us earlier today. Georgia Power has been working around the clock to get things back up and running, and there's a lot to contend with.
We've had cumulative outages since Wednesday morning when we really saw things start to pick up here of about more than 450,000 customers. Now, the good news is we've restored more than half of those, but obviously that still leaves us quite a few customers we're trying to get back on.
What is the major problem for your crews in terms of the weather? Is it snow? Is it ice, cold?
Freezing rain is the big problem for us with in terms of utility issues. Sleet is not so bad. It tends to fall off the trees and the power lines, and snow is it doesn't give you the weight unless it's really wet and heavy. But the freezing rain that freezes on contact, builds up on the trees and limbs and breaks them onto the lines, that's where we run into problems.
All right, freezing rain turns to ice. John Kraft from Georgia Power, thank you. Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate.com's Future Tense. Eric, hi.
Hi.
You heard John Kraft there saying freezing rain is the problem. Freezing rain turns to ice in Georgia and across the South. You've been writing about the tyranny of ice on power lines and even trees.
Yeah, this time yesterday morning, it was really looking kind of almost apocalyptic as far as the words that the National Weather Service were throwing around, talking about Atlanta losing a quarter of its trees and freezing rain stretching, you know, all the way from there throughout the Carolinas in this broad swath of destruction. And thankfully, what happened was the temperatures ended up being a little bit colder than expected at the surface, which pushed that freezing rain line a little bit farther south, made it a little bit more narrow. So we've seen less impact, believe it or not, than what we were expecting this time yesterday.
That's actually helped. Now, where I live, most of the power lines are buried, but I guess across the South in places like across Georgia, a lot of the power lines are above ground, and therein lies the problem.
Sure, yeah. If you've ever driven through the South, you know, around Atlanta, Atlanta's known as a city in a forest. So there's a lot of trees around. So it's just not practical for them to bury power lines, especially inner city power lines, the big overhead lines. So when some of those big trees come down, they take out a whole city's power in one fell swoop.
And before we let you go, Eric, I guess with ice, there's not much. You can't go around knocking it off of power lines. You have to wait for it to melt, essentially.
Yeah, and that was kind of the risk too overnight, is that we had some pretty gusty winds coming through with the cold front after the ice even ended. So once you combine an inch of ice with 20 mile an hour winds, you're looking at a lot of potential damage, and that's what we saw.
Yeah, up to 425,000 people in Georgia were without power. Mm-hmm. Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist who writes about weather and climate for Slate. Eric, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Todd.
The only thing I want to experience is winning a gold medal.
Sitting on the slopes of potential history.
We hit up to 6G forces.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
If you can't race yourself, you can't race anybody else.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
For a big section of the country, getting to work or school today has been kind of an Olympic sport. Although I bet none of you made it into the office like this.
She's almost at 83 miles an hour, and she is on the podium! It's a medal for Team USA
Incredible. For
the first time in luge history!
As something for the history books, Erin Hamlin, the first American to win a medal in the luge in the Winter Games. That's a bronze for Erin, thanks to NBC for that sound. But as you watch her, you wouldn't be alone if you thought, not just why does she do that, but how does she do that? There has to be more to the luge and the skeleton than a thin piece of metal and athletes with nerves of steel and a mocking disdain for the threat of head trauma. Eric Goff is our guide for our series, How Do They Do That? He's the chair of the physics department at Lynchburg College and author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports. Today's big themes are force and speed and mass.
The luge, you're going to be face up on your sled, and the skeleton, you're going to be face down. And you're not allowed to use any kind of a steering mechanism. The way these athletes have to steer is using their head and shoulders or their thighs, their leg muscles. They will make little changes in their body movements to get the luge or the skeleton to turn. And you will see them going down maybe 15 turns in all. And in both these particular events, accelerations reach up to about 5 G's. So, you know, you're sitting in your chair, you put a scale underneath you, let's say you're going to feel your weight. Now imagine multiplying that by 5. It's an enormous amount of G-force they're going to feel going around some of those turns. And the speeds are getting upwards toward 90 miles an hour. And if you take the speed you're going nearly 90 miles an hour, you take the mass of a typical sled and the athlete's mass, you're going with a much kinetic energy is about a one-ton car going 30 miles an hour. I mean, it's just an incredibly dangerous sport. They are flying down those hills.
But when you're barreling down a frozen track on a sled half your size headfirst and hitting speeds of up to 90 miles an hour, are you really thinking about physics at all? Probably not. Joining us now is former skeleton U.S. national champion Kesley Tomlinson. Kesley, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Before we talk about anything else, bronze medal for U.S. women's luge. This is a first.
Absolutely. Erin Hamlin did such an amazing job. She was a resident up in Lake Placid while I was training, and I'm just so, so proud of her and the entire Luge Federation. It was a great night for them.
Really, really exciting. Well, let's get to your experience, Kesley Tomlinson. You're not a luger. You do skeleton, which is face first, right?
Yep, it's kind of the opposite of luge. We flip around on our stomach head first.
Head first. Now, most people who are at a distance from this crazy sport would say feet first, head first. Either way you slice it, you're on two hockey skates hurtling down an ice chute at 90 miles an hour. Why why do it?
Because it looks fun. No, honestly, I got involved in the sport. I worked at the Salt Lake Olympics in 2002, and that was the first year it was back in the game since 1948. And as a young college kid walking up to the track, I was like, are you serious? This sport combines my three favorite childhood activities, sledding, roller coasters, and water slides. And so to me, it looked intriguing, and it was just something that I had to try.
I'll never get on one of those skeletons. So instead, I'm hoping that you'll sort of bring me onto the sled with you a little bit. Now, the physical forces that are on you as you're hitting these turns and sticking to the wall, can you give me a sense of what it feels like?
Well, let me start with this. So you'll hear a lot of the commentators say that, oh, the skeleton athletes, they ride with their chin just an inch off the ice. Well, that's true some of the time, but in those big pressure turns, we're pulling about 5 G's, and some of us physically can't hold up our head. So there was many times where I would actually lay my face mask on the ice when that pressure got too much. You would lay your face mask down, and then as soon as the pressure released, you could look up and see the exit of the turn. So that scraping sound I never really got comfortable with that, but you understood where you were and you were comfortable in that chaotic moment and you knew that the exit was coming. So it's just like your entire body being compressed onto your sled and then released.
You know, fighter pilots, when they pull turns, they have to do special techniques to avoid passing out. Is that anything that somebody on a skeleton has to do?
Well, I never passed out, and I am familiar because my brother flies F-18, so we talked about that sometimes.
I'm noticing a pattern in the family here.
Yeah. Speed runs in our blood. But it is. Sometimes there's certain tracks that you go down, and you can hear the rattling and chattering of your runners on the ice, but you can just feel that wind passing through your helmet or around your helmet. And it's just such a neat feeling of sort of flying on ice, if you will. But I think that's what people are drawn to, that sort of adrenaline rush.
The luge sliders, Kesley Tomlinson, go down feet first, of course, and do a bit of steering with their feet, their ankles on the front of those runners. How do you all steer when you go down head first?
Sure. Our sled flexes in a little bit different way. If we were to turn our head in a certain direction, our sled would follow. So we typically, I say head, shoulders, knees, and toes. Those are all the apparatuses we use to steer. And even though it looks, when you see these professionals at the Olympics sliding, it looks like they're literally just laying there, they're doing so much more. They're just turning their sled ever so slightly to get the perfect lines. Every single movement on your sled will affect the way it runs.
And what does it take? I've always wondered this. You come out of these hairpin turns, you're stuck to the wall because mm-hmm. of the G's. And in a split second now, you're on a flat. The physics are totally different. What does it take to avoid that disaster, which is hitting the wall and slowing down?
It completely depends on the turn, but we're sort of at the mercy of the pressures. And there's either one or two, or sometimes even 2.5 to 3 pressures in a turn. What you want to do is you want to make sure you don't get caught up in a half pressure, because that's when it can pull you back to the wall and physically dump you over and leave you without your sled.
And when you fall off, which I know has happened to you, impending dread, or is it just kind of come with the territory? Is it terrifying?
I would describe it as it just hurts.
Yeah.
People look at the ice, and you have to understand that we don't have a Zamboni to go up the ice and make it perfectly smooth. So I sort of compare the ice on the track to asphalt. So if you fall off your sled, you're going 80 miles an hour with nothing but a little bitty spandex speed suit, you're going to get quite a bit of ice burn if you're not careful.
All right. Well, Kesley Tomlinson is a former member of the Skeleton U.S. National Team and the 2008 U.S. National Champion, joining us to talk about the physics, the ins, the outs, the fear and the adrenaline, and the skill of skeleton. Kesley, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, life is full of chutes and ladders, isn't it? And love is the very steepest. Tomorrow is Valentine's Day, flowers and chocolate, unrequited love. Most of us have one, that one that got away, the person who randomly lingers in your mind all those years later. Today we're talking about finding and maybe losing that one big love. Was there one that got away from you? Down in New Orleans, Louisiana, the one that got away was gone in 2009, but I've been wearing the wedding ring she got me until last month, and it was then, after cash for golding her ring, that I truly accept that she is gone for good. So sad, but the ritual of removing that ring helps. Well, there's a sad story. How about one that worked out? From Oneonta, New York, I don't have a one that got away. My husband is the very first person I met when I walked into campus my freshman year of college. I married him 6 years later, and I am insanely in love with him. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be part of the conversation. Find us also on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Gigantic.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, we all know how school goes in America, right? It goes like this: grade school, then middle school, then 4 years of high school. And if you're lucky, then there's the added goal to go on to 2 years or 4 years of college. But there's one school in Chicago, it's called Sarah Good STEM Academy, that's working to turn that model kind of on its head. It maybe says that the old way of 4 years of high school isn't the best. At Sarah Good, students go to high school for 6 years, and when they graduate, they have that high school diploma, but also an associate's degree. The school is in a corporate partnership with IBM, and that means that students get hands-on technical and business training and also the chance to maybe land a job at IBM on graduation, maybe sort of a funnel for workers for IBM as well. New York City and Chicago are already experimenting with a handful of schools like this, and 26 more schools are going to open up in three states this fall. So the question is this maybe a model for the future of secondary education in America, or is it just kind of a well-funded trial system for a corporation's vision of education? Rana Faruhar is assistant managing editor at Time Magazine. She reported on this story for Time's cover story, which is out this week. Hi, Rana.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Also on the line, Stanley Litow. He's IBM Vice President of Corporate Citizenship, one of the people behind the Sarah Good School in Chicago. Hi, Stanley.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and good to have you. Rana, let me start with you. You've been reporting this story. 6 years of high school, and then the kids are sort of funneled towards IBM, but obviously not required to go to IBM. What do students at the Sarah Good School think they're getting out of this different sort of model of high school?
Well, you know, I've been visiting these schools now for over 2 years, both in New York and in Chicago. And I think what they feel they're getting is an amazing education with an end game that gives them the opportunity of a job, but also the opportunity to go on to other kinds of work, to a four-year college. Statistics show that kids that do get that 2 years of post-secondary education do better on all fronts. They have better earning prospects. They are more likely to go on and finish a four-year degree. They certainly do better in the workforce. I also just want to make one add. IBM doesn't actually put money into these schools. It puts expertise in. Mm. The funding comes from the existing public system, which I think makes it feel a lot better to a lot of different constituencies, educators, unions, et cetera.
Stanley Litow from IBM, are you finding that the school that you're involved in, the Sarah Good School, is attracting the kinds of students that you want for IBM, or is it taking regular old kids who you wouldn't have known about and turning them into IBM employees, potential IBM employees?
Well, the original school that started in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, PTEC and Sarah Good, are totally open admission schools. So any student in the south side of Chicago or other neighborhoods in Chicago or Crown Heights in Brooklyn or other neighborhoods in the city can gain entrance into the school. So there's no screening and picking students, hand-picking them based upon their track record or their skills. But if you look at what's actually the results at PTEC in Brooklyn and Sarah Good on the south side of Chicago is dealing with that population that is overwhelmingly free lunch eligible, many of whom had skill deficiencies when they started, their academic achievements are significantly high. So what that says is if your judgment about who would be successful in career is based upon their race or their ethnicity or where they lived or what their academic record had been, you're wrong, because given the right opportunity, any kid can be successful.
And is this, in terms of IBM's interest here, is this sort of, for corporate employers, perhaps the answer to the fact that we've been hearing about bemoaning the fact that American kids are falling behind in math and science and have been behind for 30 years?
Well, I think it's an answer to providing kids with all of the skills and all of the options that they would want. As one of the students at Sarah Good mentioned in the article that was in Time magazine, my career aspirations might be totally different. I might want to go someplace else. Some students might want to be a doctor or a lawyer, or if they want to be an engineer, we'd be happy to hire them. On the other hand, this gives every kid all of the opportunities. And IBM is not only interested in getting the best skilled employees to work for us, we're interested in getting the best skilled employees to work for our clients, to work in government, to work in all the areas that are going to make the U.S. competitive.
Rana Faruhar, Time Magazine. Is this really a model? You know, one can say, great, big city schools, Chicago, yeah. New York, big urban environments, experimental. Is this something that can crop up in Norman, Oklahoma, or in the panhandle of Texas? Is that realistic?
You know, it's going to be tougher to implement in those places, but there are calls for it. You can look at the Tennessee governor just in the last few days saying we need to make 2 years of post-secondary education free to everyone. I will say that in my years of business reporting recently, I have not seen a more common thread in interviews with big companies, mid-sized companies, small companies than we need a different kind of a labor pool. We need a more competitive workforce. We need to revamp education. education. And I think that there is this real upsurge. And I think now the thing is, can we move this into larger groups of industry? And can we start having more experiments all over the country? And I think that that's starting to happen.
Stanley Littow, before we let you go, what does it take, though, for the local or the state authorities? Education money is tight. 4 years of high school is expensive enough in terms of the tax base. You're adding two more years onto the public commitment here.
Well, what we're talking about is redirecting existing dollars. Mm-hmm. We're not spending more per pupil in this model than we would spend on any other school. And then if you sort of look at the results, if a student completes with only a high school diploma, they may earn $15 an hour maximum. If a student completes with an associate's degree, they might start at $40,000 a year or $45,000 a year. You can do the math on what that's going to do for the tax base in places like New York City or Chicago or New York State or the state of Connecticut or any other place. The modest amount of redirection of existing dollars, not more money, is going to produce significant economic return down the road. Right now, only about 25% of the students who start a community college complete. If you can move that number up to 60% or 70% or larger, the economic gains are really, really substantial.
The Sarah Good School in Chicago has kids going to school for 6 years, not four. They graduate not just with a high school diploma, but with an associate's degree. Stanley Littow is IBM's vice president for corporate citizenship. And joining me in the studio, Rana Faruhar, assistant managing editor at Time Magazine. Check out her cover story this week. Thank you both.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
9 months ago, the Boy Scouts of America lifted their longtime ban on openly gay scouts. And this week, 17-year-old Pascal Tessier became the first gay member to achieve the rank and officially be recognized as an Eagle Scout. Well, if you don't know, Eagle Scout is the highest rank that a scout can achieve. But here's the twist. In 6 months, Pascal will no longer be allowed to be part of the Boy Scouts. That's because he'll turn 18. And according to the Boy Scout guidelines, openly gay adults are not welcome. Pascal is with me today from Kensington, Maryland. Hi, Pascal.
Hello, Todd. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. How long have you been in the Scouts?
Well, I joined Cub Scouts when I was 7 years old, and I actually joined Boy Scouts when I was 11, I've been there since.
So you've been there since, which means for all of the controversy about gay Scouts and gay Scout leaders, it was never an issue for you, or your fellow Scouts and parents didn't know? What was it like for you?
Well, because of the area that we live in, my troop and everyone that I knew actually was very, very accepting of me. And it was never really an issue about the ban. And after I came out, I didn't actually know there was a ban on gay scouts and gay members in general until about a year afterwards.
How old were you when you came out?
I came out when I was in eighth grade, and I believe I was 13.
So your scouting experience since then kind of goes against the news narrative of, you know, an organization that excludes gays, because your local troop didn't really care very much.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of key to the whole idea of the complete issue, that local chapters were ready to accept gay members. However, on a national level, it was still institutionalized discrimination.
So now you're in a situation where you've achieved Eagle Scouts. I'll use the word legal just for lack of a better word. You're a legal scout now because you're 17 and you're a minor. But as we said, you're about to turn 18 and then you're out. And I don't mean out in the sense that you were out when you were 18. You're out of the organization. What has your interaction been like with the organization about your impending ouster here?
Well, really, there hasn't been any talk directly with the national level about what will happen.
Are you making a move to try and stay in?
I am trying to. Currently, I'm fighting the battle of getting adult leaders included too, but I don't think there's enough time between now and when I turn 18 that we will have made a big enough impact to change their minds and be able to keep myself into Boy Scouts.
We should remind people that this vote from the Boy Scouts several months ago allowed gay Boy Scouts in the organization, but continues to exclude gay Scoutmasters or gay adults from being part of the organization. We reached out to the Boy Scouts of America, who replied that they aren't scheduling any interviews right now, so they didn't want to join this particular segment. But Pascal, you're going to be out of the organization, as we said, at age 18. You're an Eagle Scout. What do you think that the organization might be missing by not having you around after your 18th birthday?
Well, essentially, they're missing the opportunity for me, and as well as, you know, any other gay scouts, to teach their peers, because we're still at that age where we can still connect with other scouts at a level that is, you know, peer level, because we're still very close in age. So they're missing the opportunity for peer teaching in the ways of Boy Scouts. But they're also missing the whole idea that they're the people who gave me these awards that say that I'm a, you know, a morally correct person, I can lead, I have responsibility and all these things. But after that, they're saying, we were wrong. Now you're 18 and gay. That means you're out.
Pascal Tessier is 17 years old. He's an Eagle Scout. He has been called a morally correct person by his organization, the Boy Scouts of America. But in a few months, when he's 18, he will be out of the organization because Pascal is gay. Pascal Tessier, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Follow me, boys, follow me. When you think you're really me, that's the time to lift your feet and follow me. Boys, follow me.
Well, for this next story, we're assuming that you know what day it is tomorrow. How can you forget? If a card through the slot doesn't cut it in your quest for love, online dating may be your best bet. Now, a third of all married Americans, this surprised me, claim to have met their match online. So if you're single and looking for love, you might be one of the millions of people hopefully enjoying the benefits of online dating sites. But while eHarmony and Match.com and OkCupid represent the kind of stuff of modern love, they also represent the stuff of modern technology and very, very clever computer programming. Manoush Zamarodi is the host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City, and she's been investigating the world of online dating. Hi, Manoush.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you with us. It's called machine intelligence, artificial intelligence. You know, you see the commercials and everybody claims that their algorithms match you up with the perfect person for your chemistry. You're not just at sea in a sea of randoms. How does it work?
Well, okay, so here's the best example to explain how machine learning works is really the reason why self-driving cars may take the roads in the next 10 years, right? So with self-driving cars, if you programmed the rules of driving into a car's computer, that's not going to work because if something unexpected happens, it can't react, right? It's only when you throw lots and lots of data into the car's computer that it starts to learn by figuring out patterns. And the more data or experience it takes in, the more it processes, and then it understands. So the machine gets smarter, way smarter than us. And the same thing actually applies to love and online dating. Here is how Kenneth Couquier, he's the author of Big Data and the data editor at The Economist, here's how he describes it.
You would be a fool to try to do online dating without machine intelligence, right? Without machine learning. It might look at the propensity for mixed marriages to work or not work, might determine whether they both, the parties of the couple, like rom-coms versus like thrillers. We're human beings and our optic is only just so narrow, but the machine can process a lot more data, so we have to listen to it.
At the same time, Manoush, I'm going to disclose. I've been on one of the online dating sites.
Yep.
I'm single.
Yep.
It still feels random. I look at person after person, and I still feel like it doesn't get me.
Yes, and the reason is because they haven't made all of the sort of advances that they can. But there are people looking into this. So, for example, a type of machine learning is called collaborative filtering. You're probably aware of this because let's say you use Netflix. If you are someone who loves foreign films and you love underdog political movies, it can figure out how, out of 75,000 different categories, what other movies you are likely to also like. Now, this is starting to get applied to online dating, but of course, the difference is that, you know, somebody has to like you back. The movie doesn't have to like you back, right? But with dating, it does. So we talked to Professor Kang Zhao at the University of Iowa, who is looking to apply collaborative filtering to dating, and we put the case of John to him.
Really look at your previous activity in approaching others and whether you can get responses. So we have John, who has been on the dating website for a while. He approached some ladies out there. For some ladies, he gets some responses. For some, he didn't. And then we capture this thing and we model John's taste as well as attractiveness.
So that's fine, but it doesn't account for the fact that John, like me, is really, really picky.
Well, that's the problem. That is the problem. What the machines need is data. Data, data, data. They can't make better predictions if you don't get out there, if you don't answer the questions, if you don't give them information. Here is the VP of matching for eHarmony, Steve Carter.
A funny thing happens in computer-mediated communication. It was identified in the early 90s, and it's certainly not something that's abated. People are much pickier about who they will talk to in an online dating forum than they would be if they met that exact same person in the real world.
So if that's not your added incentive, Todd, for stop browsing, start dating, get out there, and then give the machine more information, chances are you will find love. It's the humans have to work with the machines. Otherwise, this whole romance thing doesn't happen.
The humans have to work with the machines. And somehow, somehow, I don't feel more romantic about this whole process.
I'm sorry about that, Todd. Did my best.
Happy Valentine's Day, Manoush Zemirudi.
And to you.
Manoush Zemirudi is host and managing editor of WNYC's New Tech City. Manoush, thank you.
Thank you.
One year ago, two strangers in New York City met on a subway car on the F train. But the thing is, they didn't meet. Instead, they exchanged a few glances from afar and then parted ways, just two more commuters in the anonymous multitude of mass transit.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
But Jonathan Roberts decided to try and fight against the tyranny of the near miss. He went on Craigslist and posted an ad on the site's missed connections section. It's a place where you can post about an encounter, and maybe the other person will go on too, looking for you.
Baby Henry on the F train. We were on the same F train Monday evening around 5:30. I think you got on at West 4th with a baby in a sling. I was standing in the corner in a brown jacket, and I had a small cardboard box at my feet. It seemed like we kept glancing at one another, and as much as I wish I was capable of such a thing, I could never start a conversation on the train. You got off at 7th Avenue, but shortly before that, a woman started talking to you about the baby. I believe you explained that he wasn't yours and that his name was Henry. I thought you were lovely, and I'd be pretty excited if you happened upon this, remembered me, and wanted to say hello.
Hello. I'm pretty sure that I'm the train girl, but just to prove that I'm not a 65-year-old man or a 12-year-old boy, odd how online trolls always seem to be senior citizens or tweens, here are some facts. I was wearing a jean coat with plaid lining. I was carrying a giant purple bag. Chances are I kept reaching into that bag. It's the opposite of a Mary Poppins bag. You know the one that seems to have a never-ending supply of goodies? The purple bag gobbles things up. The baby fussed a bit and then would stare into other passengers' eyes. I'm happy you reached out. What's your name? Abby.
Those are the voices of Jonathan Roberts and Abby Spector, who found each other on Missed Connections and have been together for 1 year since. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks.
Hi.
Good to have you. Jonathan, New York City, any place, but New York City in particular, is notorious for being a colony of ants, especially on the subway. You bump into one, you go your opposite direction. What made you decide to not be an ant for once and try to reach out?
Luckily that day there weren't too many ants on this particular train, so I was standing in a corner and had a pretty clear view of Abby, and she had a clear view of me, and we spent 30 minutes or so looking at each other. And I've been here for years and ridden a lot of trains, but never had anything like that happen.
And you're not the guy, though, who's going to walk across the car and say hi.
Oh, no.
Why?
Well, sometimes I'm not the guy that wants to walk across the room and say hi to my friends, I guess. I'm pretty quiet. Love my friends. Sorry, guys. But I figured I wouldn't make the impression I wanted to make. I would probably say something silly. So I thought it's safer to go home and write something silly.
Which is risky because she might not go on Craigslist. And Abby, meanwhile, you're on the F train making eyes at this guy who you don't know, who's cute but could be a weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
Were you hoping he would come over, or were you happy just to glance from afar?
I was hoping he would come over, but didn't think he actually would, or I mean, my assumption was that I had a booger on my face or something, and that's why he was staring at me. but it would have been great if he came over, but I also understood that I had a baby attached to my chest, so that's not exactly an invitation for people to come over.
Sure, because you're probably a young mom.
I'm probably a young mom, right. But I was talking loudly about how the baby wasn't mine to the woman next to me, hoping that the guy would hear.
Just to make sure he would get the message. Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, I get then why you would go home and resort to misconnections, because you felt like you had a misconnection. But Abby, you did too, and the amazing part of this story is that you both had the same thought for the same website. What made you go home and say, well, geez, it's a one in a million shot, but I'm going to get on Craigslist and just browse?
I thought, what the hell? I might as well, in the one in the million chance, billion chance that this happened.
So what was your initial feeling when you saw the message to the girl with the baby on the F train? You knew it was you right away, didn't you?
I was so happy. I ran around my apartment jumping and laughing. I was floored.
And how long did you spend on your friendly and accessible reply that you read?
Probably not long enough. I just wanted to reply as soon as possible. I didn't know if he wrote these things every day looking for someone.
And Jonathan, you have friends who are on Match or OkCupid or eHarmony and all these things. We all know people who are on those websites. It's very common. But what do your friends think of the irony of you two getting connected via the internet when they're all trying to sort of reverse engineer a connection on the internet?
Well, my best friend got married last year to someone he met on a website, so he's okay with it. Mm-hmm. It's worked for some of them. But if you meet someone through one of those other websites the first time you show up at a bar or restaurant to meet this person, you hope you would kind of have the immediate reaction that she and I seem to be having on the train.
Abby, how about you? Your friends see the irony if they're on OkCupid and you're sort of meeting somebody the opposite way?
I mean, they kind of just think, holy cow, how does that happen? They're kind of just impressed that it happened, I think.
Yeah, well, what you guys have done, I think, is won two love lotteries, the one of meeting on the F train in the first place and then hitting the jackpot a second time and crossing paths on Craigslist.
I feel pretty lucky.
Congratulations. What a love story.
Thanks.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Same to you.
That's Jonathan Roberts and Abby Spector, who met on the F train in New York and then met again via Craigslist misconnections. Well, there's one fantastic story of love for this Valentine's Day. We've been asking you for your stories of love gained or love lost. How about this one from a listener in Texas? It was almost 10 years ago that we dated. I had a dream about her last night, and I dream about her about once a month. I really love that girl. From Easton, Pennsylvania, there were periods in our lives when we couldn't see each other and I needed separation and to move on. I never really let him get away. There's been no romance between us for many years, and our spouses don't always love the fact that we're so close. We're still friends and always will be. Now, I think there might have been a movie or two shockingly similar to that plot.
Vanessa Johnson from Sarasota, Florida. I was 17 when I moved from Illinois to Florida. And a few months later, I sent my boyfriend, who I was going to marry, Dear John letter, to him in the Army saying that I had met someone else. And I still, 30 plus years later, still feel bad. And I wonder if he was the one.
Do you wonder if someone was the one, or are you with the one? 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. There's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. We go to Washington now, where after 3 years of brinksmanship, confrontation, and threatened defaults, both the House and the Senate have agreed to raise the debt ceiling without conditions all the way until March of 2015. Now, that means no more debt limit confrontations at all. But it doesn't mean the end of the confrontation between conservatives and the Tea Party and Republican leaders. And you could see that in action itself over the last couple of days. Just yesterday, Senate Republicans were unable to overcome a filibuster on that debt limit increase from within their own ranks. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, to be exact. Republicans unwilling to risk the anger of the right refused to go against Cruz until GOP leader Mitch McConnell and his deputy, Texas Republican John Cornyn, basically locked arms and leapt together and voted to break that filibuster. Now, that's a big deal if you're McConnell and Cornyn, because both of those Republican leaders are facing primary challenges in their home states. And McConnell especially is in a very, very tough fight to keep his seat. White House spokesman Jay Carney called it, though, a positive step. Listen.
It's not a reward to any president, a Democrat or Republican, for Congress to do its fundamental responsibility. It is the least that Congress can and should do.
Now, all of this followed a surprise vote in the House on Tuesday after Speaker John Boehner reversed years of confrontation over the debt limit and voted along with just about 20 or so GOP lawmakers to raise the debt limit.
The yeas are 221. The nays are 201. The bill is passed.
That's the debt limit passing there. John Boehner had once declared that he would refuse any increase in the debt limit without corresponding budget cuts. And as you'll remember, this insistence led to a partisan standoff that helped lead to the government shutdown and previous threats to default on our debt and a credit downgrade. So why has the GOP leadership changed its mind? And is the right even more enraged now that their leaders seem to have given up on the issue? We're going to start with Congressman Tom Cole, representing Oklahoma's 4th District, friend of the show and friend of John Boehner. Hi, Congressman.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, and thanks for joining us. Now, we should say at the top, Congressman, you voted against the debt ceiling increase, correct?
I did.
But you also gave some praise to the speaker and said he wants to get the issue taken care of, that John Boehner is the adult in the room. Now, how do we square those two things? You voted against it. Why? Because you don't want to get primaried, or?
No, frankly, I voted to increase the debt ceiling in 2011 because I thought we had a reasonable arrangement with the President of the United States. He was willing to sit down and negotiate. And while we raised the debt ceiling, we also cut long-term spending by $2 billion. The sad thing is the president's evidently lost any interest in both negotiating and reducing the deficit.
Now, a lot of people have sort of looked at this, and of course, in politics, your point of view is often what matters. On the one hand, the speaker has surrendered. He said, okay, raise the debt limit, no conditions, I give up. On the other hand, almost every Republican, at least in the House, gets to vote against something that Republicans don't like. So advantage or disadvantage, Boehner?
Well, I think advantage. Advantage first, because he made the larger political point that it's both the president and the Democrats that don't want to address the deficit. He's willing to do that. Second, he obviously protected his members and, more importantly and profoundly, protected the country. Nobody believes in default. We've got the debt ceiling there to force Congress to confront the debt whenever we reach that point, so that we just don't willy-nilly keep raising it as if it were a credit card without a limit to it. And, again, we had a president that acted responsibly in 2011. I might add for the record, by the way, the president was asking us to do something he never did when he was in the Senate. He certainly didn't help George Bush raise the debt ceiling. He voted no and actually gave us a long lecture on how we needed to deal with the debt. 2011, he actually did that. This time, he chose not to, and frankly, his party joined him in that.
So, Congressman Cole, you make the point that the speaker succeeded in making the president and Democrats maybe own the debt limit. And I can sort of see those 30-second ads in the election. You know, at the same time, though, the Tea Party, as you know, doesn't necessarily see it that way. They see a Speaker of the House who's capitulating, who didn't hold the line on budget cuts. And worse than that, maybe for Mitch McConnell, they see a Republican leader who voted to break Ted Cruz's filibuster. He's in a tough primary. Now, Boehner may have helped a lot of House Republicans, but he did not help Mitch McConnell.
Well, frankly, he did help Mitch McConnell. The thing that Mitch McConnell needs most is to win the majority. And frankly, by not having some sort of crisis and potential shutdown, he enormously increased the chances of Republicans winning the United States Senate in November. So I think if you asked Mitch McConnell whether or not he got help, he would tell you he did.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll get the chance to ask Mitch McConnell if he got help. That's Congressman Tom Cole, representing Oklahoma's 4th District, voted against that debt limit increase, but had praise for the speaker. Congressman, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Matt Kibbe. Matt is president and CEO of FreedomWorks, one of those Tea Party type groups who not only urged members to vote against the debt limit increase, but Matt, your organization has called for the ouster of Speaker Boehner.
Yeah, I do think it's time for new leadership, and it's certainly frustrating to watch that the president lecture all of us on something that he refused to do himself as a senator. But the fact of the matter is House Republicans in particular promised fiscal responsibility. They promised to rein in spending, and they were quite specific about it when they ran in 2010. And there's been no clear strategy to drive that. You know, our members, the freshmen and the sophomores that we broadly call the Tea Party caucus, have offered various solutions along the way. First, we drove this plan called Cut, Cap, and Balance. Later, we tried to defend the sequester. And realizing that nothing is perfect in the legislative process, my question to Republicans is, what are you going to do given your majority in the House?
Well, Congressman Cole, as you heard, makes the point that Speaker Boehner did Republicans a favor. He says that he did Mitch McConnell a favor, who has a tough Tea Party challenge in Kentucky, a race that you guys are involved in. Do you think Boehner, that Speaker McConnell did himself a favor by breaking Ted Cruz's filibuster on the debt limit?
No, I think he's created a huge problem for himself, because he has said again and again, Mitch McConnell has promised to rein in spending. He really drew a line in the sand over the debate over the sequester savings, arguing that we cannot abandon the sequester. And then not only did he abandon it, but he engineered the process by which we went back to business as usual. And again, the point is, we're not looking for perfection, but at some point, somebody has to be an adult in Washington, because we can't continue to spend money we don't have. Just because the president wants to doesn't mean that Republicans get a blank check.
Just this week, Speaker John Boehner relinquished his leverage on the debt limit and passed a clean debt limit increase. That sort of ends the argument for now with the president, but it does not end the argument with folks like Matt Kibbe. Matt Kibbe is president and CEO of FreedomWorks, a Tea Party-affiliated conservative political action organization. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
We also heard from Tom Cole, Republican congressman representing Oklahoma's 4th District. Well, we've been talking about love and about missed connections here today. We're asking you, who have you missed? Were they on the train? Were they in the library? We want to know, who's the one who got away from you? Victor Garza from Portland, Oregon. We just aren't in the same place spiritually, ethically, body care-wise. But OMG, when I look at him, OMG, and indeed, Victor, OMG.
Hi, this is Diane Buckner from Longview, Washington. My first love. Met him in his sailor blues. Sadly, for some reason, I Googled his name and found out that he had passed away. That taught me a big lesson. Leave the past in the past.
We want to hear your stories of missed connections and found love at 8778-MY-TAKE. Tweet us about the one who got away at The Takeaway. I'm not getting away. I'll be here tomorrow. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. Hope you'll join us then. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.